What are the Maple Leafs getting in Tyson Barrie and Alex Kerfoot?
Well, I mean, they're going to get a puck-moving defenseman that they desperately needed, but one that has some defensive limitations. But that's okay, because I think that his upside offensively and his ability to move the puck is something that I felt the lineup was lacking a bit. And in Kerfoot, they're getting a downgrade from Kadri, but they're also getting a guy who might not go bat poop crazy in the first round of the playoffs and get suspended against the Bruins next year, which is kind of an essential ingredient, I think, if you're the Leafs right now.
Good word. Yeah, 14 playoff games over the past 2 years for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Nazem Kadri played in 6 of them. Not exactly ideal. I feel like you love chaos. Who are you cheering for in this whole offer sheet thing? You want him to leave to Montreal or stay with Carolina?
Oh, I mean, initially, I think I was with everybody and was hoping that Montreal could pull it off just because we so rarely see these, obviously the first one since 2013. But now I don't want them rewarded for basically not doing the job. I mean, you know, if this had been a larger offer sheet, if they had gone to the next category, maybe they have a shot at actually getting him because the compensation is what it is, because the dollar amount would have been what it is. But as it stands, it's more of a nuisance than anything. I mean, you know, $21 million in the first year is something that no team wants to structure a contract around. So that's kind of a nuisance. And walking him up to unrestricted free agency, also a nuisance. I think they were trying to prey on the idea that Tom Dundon didn't want to outlay that kind of money for Sebastian Aho, which isn't necessarily true. And so I feel like they kind of dipped their toe in the offer sheet tub, but didn't jump in. And I wouldn't want to see them rewarded for it. I think they actually kind of let their fans down yesterday with that offer sheet.
Wish, we know that some offer sheets in the past, the Shea Weber, the Ryan O'Reillys, those guys eventually left their teams. We know that the Canes can't trade Sebastian Aho for 365 days once he signs the offer sheet. Is he going to play out this entire contract in Raleigh, or do you think there is something to be said about guys accepting offer sheets and eventually that's the beginning of the end and the team?
I don't know. It's an interesting question because, you know, there's a lot of that information being put out right now by the Habs that he, you know, he wants to be here and all this other stuff. You know, we've not obviously heard from Aho yet to kind of round out that notion. But it's sort of an individual by individual situation. I think in Carolina, there's some really smart hockey people in that front office that are also very analytic in their approach. And I think that when you have that approach, you can park your feelings and understand that, you know, the player is the player. And, you know, if he's under contract, he's under contract. I don't see Sebastian Aho becoming a malcontent just because he didn't get his way on an offer sheet. But there remains to be seen, because there can be, just like in any contractual situation, whether it's a nasty arbitration hearing or an offer sheet situation, there can be kind of some lingering after effects. And again, like if you're Carolina, you'd much rather have a situation like Braden Point in Tampa, who has sort of been adamant behind the scenes that he doesn't want to leave the team, and that's why he's not interested in dabbling in the dark arts of offer sheets, even though the Lightning are in a precarious situation. He could probably leave if he wanted to. So maybe, you know, if you're Carolina, you do kind of side-eye the fact that Aho, you know, put pen to paper on one.
So here's the hockey agenda at the moment. So we're all sort of glued, waiting to see what happens with this offer sheet. Now, then it either moves to whatever the next offer sheet is, because if the Aho one is unsuccessful, maybe there's another one. In the absence of that, we complain about Mitch Marner and his dad for a little bit longer, and that's going to be annoying. But once that's resolved, I think everything looks at the New Jersey Devils, Greg Wyshynski's New Jersey Devils, and Taylor Hall.
Is.
Yeah, buddy. Do you think the Devils, with their recent acquisitions and signings, do you think they're actually trying to keep this guy? Do you think they can keep this guy?
Oh, I think they can. I think the thing with Taylor was he's at a point in his career where he needs to feel like he's going to be with a winner. And if nothing else, the Devils have a course forward with Jack Hughes and Nico Hischier up the gut for the next decade. And I think that the Subban trade not only improves the team exponentially on their blue line for the next 3 seasons, but also is sort of the you know, level of financial commitment to a star player that you want to see from ownership to know that, hey, even if things don't work out in the next couple of years as far as championship contention, they're going to be aggressive in trying to keep the team competitive while I'm there. So it was sort of a declarative statement. And again, I don't read anything into Taylor Hall taking his time on his contract. He's been really on some horrible teams and really would like to be a winner and be in the playoffs and challenge for a cup. And, you know, I think taking due diligence with the jersey situation, talking to everybody in his life to figure out what the next step should be is only natural at this point. But I think the Devils have done some really good things and have sort of obviously lucked into some situations that put them in a good position to try to retain him.
Greg, yesterday we saw some questionable contracts doled out. We saw some nice, potentially, contracts offered. Which is the best contract from yesterday, and which one's the worst?
The worst is obvious, and it's not because it's a bad contract. It's because of the team that signed it, which is the Matt Zuccarello deal. Like, 6-5 for Zuck isn't bad. I mean, that's sort of where the contract should be for a player of his talents, but the Minnesota Wild are an old team and a team that's not anywhere near championship contention. So adding that player for that term and that money to that roster is just nonsensical. It's an owner scratching and clawing and trying to stay relevant instead of doing what he should do, which is to go in the tank for a little bit and wipe the slate clean. Best contract, the Donskoy one, I'm a huge Jonas Donskoy fan, and I think that he's going to be a real asset for Colorado in filling out that lineup. They did a really good job building out their bottom six and also you could say their second line as well yesterday. But I also love the Pavelski deal. And I know that he's older, and I know that $7 million is a lot for a player like that. But you think about what the Dallas Stars needed and, you know, a guy that can establish a second line for them, a guy that gives them a net front presence, and a guy who literally bleeds for his team in the playoffs and leads by that example, I think is something that Dallas really, really needed on that roster to try to actualize as a contender in the West. I thought it was a really, really shrewd move to bring him in there.
Wish, pointing the finger at absolutely nobody in particular, should we stop inducting active general managers into the Hockey Hall of Fame?
Steve, it's what they've built. They're builders. They've, you know, it's you build a building, the building's still there, even if your next building is, you know, falls down.
Yeah, but right? what if they tore it down for no good reason, and then offered a 6-year contract to Brandon Tanev?
Yeah, I completely understandable. And then on top of the Jack Johnson contract in the previous season, Jimmy Rutherford, by virtue of winning cups with two different teams, has his ticket punched to immortality already.
Yes.
But we're starting to see some cracks in the foundation as far as his managerial plan for that team. The Tanev deal is just baffling. The Johnson deal last year was baffling. I'm still jury's out on the Kessel trade just to see what they end up doing with that cap space maybe next summer, you know, depending on what they do with Galchenyuk. But if you're a Penguins fan, it must be maddening right now to see this roster and try to figure out the pathway back to contention after dealing away a point per game player like that.
Yeah, you got Twitter, right? They're not handling it very well, man.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's what my favorite thing in the last week has been to see exactly which guys in the Pittsburgh media, in particular on Pittsburgh radio, have been hauling water in tanker trucks for ownership just so they can keep on getting great guests while everybody else is, you know, logically looking at these deals and saying, what the hell are the Penguins doing?
Is potentially Malkin the next guy that they would actually entertain training?
Let's go.
I've heard from so many people in Pittsburgh that say that Mario will never trade Malkin. Like, they just won't allow it. Like Sid and Malkin are Penguins for life unless they make the decision not to be there anymore. So they're never going to do that unless he wants to leave. I think that's sort of an edict that's been handed down from God himself in Pittsburgh, just based on everything I've heard with regard to that situation. We'd all love to see it. I mean, you know, it's that dream of what could Pippen have done without Jordan as prime kind of deal. But I don't think it's going to ever happen. I think Sid and Gino are going to be there as long as Sid and Gino want to be there.
I don't know, man. I don't know. I just feel like isn't loyalty dead in professional sports? Like, couldn't even a guy like Mario turn at some point?
I mean, sure. I mean, you know, at some point Yager left, right? So, I mean, he was also a malcontent, which I think is the bigger issue there. But it's always a possibility, and may get to a point where the Penguins are a non-factor, to the point where Malkin doesn't even want to be there anymore. Who's to say? But I just know that as far as, like, actively using him to improve the rest of the team by offloading him for a massive package, it's just something that I don't think they're looking at. They're looking to build around those two guys versus to, you know, peel off one to fill in the blanks.
National hockey writer for ESPN, Greg Wyshynski, joining us here, Sportsnet today. Stephen George, Sportsnet, 590 The Fan. Wish the Flames signed Cam Talbot, and they have Big St. Dave, David Riddick, as their 1-2 heading into the season. How comfortable should Flames fans be for a team that finished number one in the Western Conference last year, was upset in the first round by the Avalanche? We all saw it. How confident should they be in that goaltending in Calgary?
I don't know. Do the teams in Alberta know there's goaltenders outside of the province that they can go and try to acquire?
There's better ones out there.
It's the most incestuous thing that happened yesterday was the do-si-do of the Oilers and Flames and their goaltenders. Look, the Flames are a really good team. I still think there's another shoe to drop as far as their blue line and the future of TJ Brody there, who I think is going to be on the move at some point this summer. There are still moves to be made. I would love for them to figure out the James Neal situation. I'm not in love with the idea of trying to go make another go at it with a guy that so did not work out last year. So I think some tweaks are in order for that roster. But, I mean, the foundation's pretty sturdy for at least the next couple of years, even with the specious goaltending tandem that they have. I mean, you hope that Rittich can give you what he gave you last year. If not, they're in trouble, but I'm kind of confident that guy is going to at least be, you know, close to what he was last year.
You were recently at the draft in Vancouver. I know because I saw you. The number one question I was asked by the locals, if you will, was, do the Canucks think they're good? What do you think the Canucks are?
First of all, don't even pretend that the number one question that you got wasn't, can you sign my fancy book that you authored, my internet hero.
Listen, enough about this team is ruining my life, but I love them, available in bookstores now. Do the Canucks think they're good? I think was the question. The book is not called Do the Canucks Think They're Good. It's called This Team Is Ruining My Life, But I Love Them, author Steve Dangle Glick. What was the question? Do the Canucks think they're good?
I think that they think they're getting closer to being good. Look, they have some time to suss out some things. I think they're probably 2 years away. Do they know that? Maybe they do. I mean, the Myers deal is a reach. I think we all know that as far as he's going to be in that lineup. But they're not dumb. I mean, they can read the birth certificates on Brock Besser and Elias Pettersson and Quinn Hughes and know that, you know, they can take a year to kind of just power up a little bit and then make a go of it in 2 years to really be a contender in the West. I mean, at least I hope that's how they view it, because I think that's the logical path right now. You know, let this year play out. If they contend, great. If not, then, you know, you've got this incredible core of young players to go forth in the following year to really make a go of it.
So the Canucks made a big old bunch of moves, and some people weren't so sure about it. You sort of touched on the Oilers for a second, and other than taking one of Calgary's goalies, they didn't really do anything. And they weren't very good last year, and they didn't do anything. So what exactly is Ken Holland doing? You think he's just taking his time, or are there actually no options out there for the Oilers?
No, there are going to be options. They've got cap space to play with. So I think right now their best course of action is to do what other teams have done and kind of wait around and see if something shakes loose from somebody's tree insofar as the salary that they have to move. And that's a good way about going about it, to maybe get a player that has a little bit of term or what have you to add to the roster. I think that's a smart decision. The problem for Ken Holland right now is Peter Chiarelli, who I don't think people really understand the damage this guy did. I mean, it's like when you take your wired earbuds out of your backpack and spend the next, you know, 20 minutes untangling them before you can listen to music. It's just like, it's going to take some time to figure out how to offload Milan Lucic and fix the defense and find a winger for Nugent Hopkins. I mean, it was malfeasance the way that he managed that team. And Ken Holland not only has to come in and try to make them good now, but also, you know, untangle that mess and make them good in the future. And that's a hell of a task. I mean, he's one of the few guys I might trust to figure it out. But I mean, that's why they can't make moves, is because they're completely shackled by the nonsense that went on for the last couple of seasons.
It reminds me a little bit of the Leafs situation a few years ago, where they were, you know, the Leafs for so long, and who could possibly solve this mess? And they go and they bring Lou Lamoriello in. If Ken Holland can't fix what's going on in Edmonton, I'm not sure anyone can.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, they've got the core there, and they've got some pieces there. But there's just not enough of those pieces. And I think that, you know, whether it was drafting and developing, whether it was, you know, the veteran acquisitions, almost every step that franchise took under Chiarelli's, you know, stewardship was the wrong one. And they're paying for it now. And good luck to Ken Holland in trying to figure it out.
We saw Termi Panarin sign that monster deal. He's now the highest paid winger. Did that seem like a fit to you with the Rangers? Is that a team that's ready to win now? It's just, I find it curious that we know they had the number two pick in the draft and they're kind of in a rebuild, and Henrik Lundqvist has 2 years left on his enormous contract. Did it make sense at this time for the Rangers to grab Panarin?
Absolutely, because you never know when a player of that caliber is going to become available again when you are ready to contend. And he's not going to get any worse in, say, like the next 3 years, when I think they're going to be really good. At the very least, you've got a winger who has proven himself to be able to drive a line on his own, to play with guys like Chatel and guys like Elias Anderson and some of the young centers that you have on that roster. So it's early to get him, no question. I don't think the Rangers are going to be, you know, making an exponential leap in quality next season, even with Kako being as good as he's going to be. But to get him in now and to have him grow with this young core that they have, I think was a really smart decision. And again, let's not forget, it's also James Dolan dunking on Brooklyn the day after Brooklyn took Kevin Durant away from the Knicks, which is a beautiful sort of sidebar story to this Rangers getting Panarin away from the Islanders situation yesterday.
Speaking of Brooklyn, what the heck happened with Robin Lehner, man?
Well, to hear Robin Lehner talk about it yesterday, he was on a conference call yesterday and was, as Robin Lehner is, quite candid about things. The Islanders kind of came to him with an offer. He wasn't thrilled about the money. He took some time to mull it over. They gave him an ultimatum to say, hey, get back to us in a few hours. And then by the time he got back to him, in his words, they had moved on to another goalie. I have a pet theory about this, and I don't think I actually wrote on our winners and losers thing this morning about it, but I'm going to put it out here. Do you guys remember when Kovalchuk signed with the Devils? It was between the Devils and the Kings, and Lou Lamoriello made a curious signing that summer. He signed Jonas Hedberg to be a backup goalie for the Devils. Now, Hedberg at the time had the same agent as Kovalchuk, Jay Grossman, and the thought was, he's signing this one guy and giving him a pretty decent contract as a make good with the agent to get in his good graces and try to get Kovalchuk to Jersey. So when it became apparent that Varlamov and Panarin shared the same agent, it was like deja vu. I'm like, oh, he's trying to do the same thing here. Sign the goalie to get the high-priced forward to come to your team. But then the high-priced forward went to the Rangers and they still signed the goalie, which was the curious part.
That's really interesting stuff. I like that.
I don't get it.
Thank you.
I really don't get what's going on with the Islanders, but I'm also afraid to write them off.
I'll say this. The thing that people have to understand about Varlamov, one, he can be a very good goalie when he's healthy. I think there are considerations for the groin injuries and the hip injuries he's had. But more than anything, he signed for 4 years. Within those 4 years, Ilya Sorokin, their blue chip franchise level goaltender that's in the KHL right now, is expected to hop over after this season. He knows Sorokin. I think they see him as a mentor for the kid. He's going to, you know, make the transition from Russia to North America a lot easier. I can't separate that from this decision to move off of Lehner. So that could be a factor in this as well.
Was it curious that the Blackhawks signed him? Now they're paying him $5 million, and Corey Crawford, who by the way delivered a couple Stanley Cups to them, at $6 million, and now they're both UFAs heading into next season. Can you make sense of this goaltending situation in Chicago now?
I think the first step is to know that, you know, they obviously have some considerations for Crawford's health, and when that's the case, and they can't obviously offload that deal anywhere unless they kind of buy him out or whatever, because he's got a no move and he makes a lot of money and he's been in and out of the lineup. I think it's a smart move to shore up that position, as even if it's in sort of an insurance way, because if Crawford gets hurt and you don't have somebody like Lehner there, then your entire season goes sideways, you know, pretty quickly. And then on the other hand, you kind of have two guys, one of whom is, I think, 5 years younger than the other, maybe even more, kind of vying for their next contract as well. So there's a lot of good reasons to do it. And then, you know, with the idea that maybe whoever wins out that competition gets a new contract and is kind of a placeholder until a younger goalie is ready to come up. So I didn't mind it. It's a lot of money to tie up in your goaltending spot for sure. But for the situation the Blackhawks are in, I didn't think it was the worst decision on their part.
How excited are you to watch Senators games next year?
I mean, not really at all.
Why?
Why would I be excited to watch Senators games next year?
They're a team?
I mean, they are a team for sure. Yeah. I mean, they're just sort of like, I don't know, they're like fighting Glass Joe and Mike Tyson's punch out at this point. You just get past that and you get to the opponents you really want to fight, right? So, like, I just feel bad for those fans, and I feel bad for anybody. You know, I thought Pierre Dorion did really well at the trade deadline. He was one of my winners at the trade deadline because I thought he leveraged those assets as far as they could be leveraged. And then, you know, you go and you trade a third-round pick for the honor of taking on a toxic contract, and you're like, what the hell are you doing? I mean, you're back at square one with this guy.